coming tonight and engaging in this topic. It's a topic that I'm personally very passionate about, and I'm really grateful to all of you for being here to learn with us and with Rabbi Weiner this evening. I really want to thank Dina for hosting us in her beautiful home. And our committee of volunteers who planned this evening, Robin Cardoza, Amy Stark, Sylvia Barocas, Sharon Saltiel, and Chaya Servin, who helped make tonight happen. Thank you so much. So today, I spoke with three different women, volunteers for Sharsheret, who are all BRCA positive, and who all inherited the mutation from their dad. And other than that, they don't have much in common. They actually don't even live in the same state. But they are all dealing with the reality of carrying the BRCA mutation. And with the fact that breast cancer and ovarian cancers and the hereditary risk for these cancers, it's not just a Jewish women's issue, it's a Jewish family issue. And because it's a Jewish family issue, Sharsheret is here. And Sharsheret, which means chain into Hebrew, is really founded on the idea that we know that this is an issue in our community. We know that people are facing it every day. And we really just want to be there for people, wherever you are on your journey, for you and your family, while you're going through this illness. We provide free support, psychosocial support by phone to Jewish families all across the country in all 50 states. I'm based in our LA office, but our services are truly everywhere. And we offer financial assistance for non-medical needs, including for wigs and cold capping for hair preservation. And we actually are about to launch at the end of this fall a program to help people with rent and car payments as needed while they're going through treatment. And we also offer community education. You're going to have potentially a lot of questions about genetics tonight. We have a genetic counselor at Sharsheret who is available totally for free, totally confidential, not involving insurance, to answer any of your questions and talk with you about your family medical history and to discuss if genetic testing is right for you. She texts, is that what you said, Amy?
She's excellent.
Oh, she's excellent. I was going to say, she does also text.
She does text.
Yes, Peggy is excellent. She certainly answers my questions every week as well. So if you didn't share your email with us tonight, please make sure you do before the end of the evening, because I will send out information about Sharsheret and about connecting with her if you have any personal questions. So this evening, we are going to hear first from Glenna, who's going to share her story. I'm going to just come back and share a little bit more about genetics and do a little bit of genetics 101 for you. And then we have the wonderful Rabbi Weiner here tonight to share his wisdom with all of us. So first, I'm going to invite up Glenna to share her story.
So I'm going to read to you my mom's parting message to me. So I'm here today to share the message that I received from my mother as she was dying from metastatic breast cancer. She passed away 2 weeks ago at the age of 82. After a long battle with breast cancer. Unfortunately, due to the lack of regular checkups and mammograms, we don't know when the cancer started. By the time we found out, the cancer had already metastasized to many bones in her body. As my mother's illness progressed, I realized that I needed to take initiative with my health. Earlier this year, I was diagnosed with DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. Fortunately, my case was caught in the early stages. I chose to do the genetic testing since my mother had breast cancer, and the test results came back that I am a carrier of the BRCA2 gene. I'm glad that I was able to find out this information at this point in my life to prevent future cancers and to help inform my siblings and my children. Last June, my mom started to experience pain in her shoulder. She had severe pain shooting down her arm, causing a frozen shoulder, arm, and hand. When we got the results of the MRI, it showed a large mass on the shoulder. I asked the doctor what he thought it was, and he said likely cancer because it had metastasized to the bone. In October, my mother was hospitalized at Cedars-Sinai and had surgery to put rods and plates supporting the femur bone that was eroded from the tumors. That was when we received the diagnosis of an estrogen-receptive metastatic breast cancer. There were multiple tumors on the spine and lungs. During her 2.5-week stay at Cedars-Sinai, Rabbi Weiner, the chaplain at Cedars-Sinai, came to visit many times and gave us food for Shabbos. He even put a refrigerator in the room. We are so grateful to him for his gentle kindness. From the hospital, my mother was transferred to a rehab where she stayed for 2.5 weeks, and I set up her home for wheelchair and walker access. A dear family friend put ramps and bars in the home as well. My father, who's 87, Kananahara, tirelessly took my mother to the bathroom every night for 9 months, and he never complained. A week after returning home, my mother began radiation to the chest area to reduce swelling in the arm and radiation to the femur bone where the surgery took place. We went every day from November 18th until December 21st. My mom had a really good attitude during radiation. She was so friendly to all the staff. We finally felt some sense of stability. My mother was taking the cancer medication and doing occupational and physical therapy in January, February, and March. Her CT scan in April showed no significant tumor growth. Her oncologist, Dr. McAndrews, told us to keep doing what we were doing. Healing is a 24/7 job. I went to sleep every night praying and thinking about what I was going to cook for my parents the next day. Unfortunately, my mom slipped and fell on May 1st, breaking her left humerus bone and fracturing 2 ribs. She had another surgery to put rods in place on the left arm to stabilize the humerus bone, which was brittle due to the cancer. My mom never gave up or got discouraged. She always had hope. In June, her oxygen levels were low due to the cancer damaging her lungs and causing fluid to build up in them. We got used to having oxygen in the home and a portable tank for travel. By July, she was frail, unable to walk, and had little vitality due to low hemoglobin levels and other cancer-related issues. Her oncologist and pain management doctor agreed that the cancer treatment was not helping. My mom was on a ventilator in the ICU. All she wanted to do was go home. Rabbi Weiner helped us work with the doctors and the social workers to help my mom come out of the ICU. My mom died peacefully in her home in a hospice bed on July 14th, looking out onto her garden. I had a lot of support from close family members as I navigated these uncharted waters. My husband was there by my side throughout this difficult time. He went to the market. He brought cheer on Shabbos. He took care of my father, going to all the minions with him. He listened whenever it was overwhelming. My niece, Hava, an occupational therapist in Lakewood, New Jersey, and beloved granddaughter, helped me with all the medical decisions. We spoke daily and felt that it was our mission to help heal my mom. I also consulted with my brother, a pediatrician in Detroit, Michigan, throughout my mom's illness for advice. I was reading every health book I could find and cooking healthy food for my parents and my husband. My mom taught me the importance of living a healthy and fulfilled life. My parents were married for 61 years. I have one older brother and one younger sister. My mom was a devoted grandmother and great-grandmother. My mom and I worked together as artists in her studio at home. She was my mentor and inspiration. Hashem gave me a gift that our daughter, our youngest child, Rivka, got engaged the same week my mom passed away. My mom never got to meet her chassan, but she spent time with Rivka sharing her joy. In February, I decided to do a physical at Kaiser while taking care of my mother full time. In March, I did a mammogram and was called back for a second mammogram and then a biopsy determining DCIS in the left breast. Since my mother had breast cancer, I did genetic testing and the results showed that I had the gene mutation BRCA2, which puts me at a higher risk for ovarian and breast cancer. My husband and I spoke with a genetic counselor and I opted to do a lumpectomy since at the time I was the primary caregiver for my mother. On May 10th, I did the lumpectomy, having no pain afterwards except for an allergic reaction to the soap. I developed an itchy rash that lasted for 6 days. The surgeon said that the DCIS was 2 centimeters and that I cleared 5 out of the 6 margins but needed a second lumpectomy to get the rest. I did that one on June 9th. Thankfully, the recovery was smooth. We spoke with a gynecological oncologist who suggested that I remove the ovaries. I only had one remaining ovary since the first one was removed when I was 14 when I had a painful benign ovarian cyst. They removed the ovary, the cyst, and the tubes when I was 14. I asked the doctor if I would be able to have children, and he said you can have up to 14 children on one ovary. Thankfully, I have 4 healthy children. I had the remaining ovary removed on June 21st. Recently, I spoke with the radiologist who said that my DCIS was nuclear grade 3 and likely to return. I changed my mind about going forward with radiation and taking medication for 5 years after the lumpectomy. Instead, I chose to do a double mastectomy after my daughter's wedding in November. I have an appointment this week to talk to a plastic surgeon to discuss the reconstruction. Cancer can come even if a person lives a healthy lifestyle. It's important to have regular checkups and mammograms along with healthy eating and exercise. Fortunately, I found Sharsheret at this time to help support my journey going forward. My mother was a very talented artist, always drawing, painting, and showing her work. My mom took up ceramics later in life. She introduced me to ceramics when my children were young. I love working with clay. I feel in touch with myself, nature, and the world around me, sort of a reconnection with my hands, heart, and mind. She loved to appreciate the beauty in life and cherished her family. She had a special relationship with so many of her family members and friends. Thank you, Mom, for the many gifts that you left behind, devotion to family, your amazing creative energy, and awareness of how to care for myself. May this story be an education for others and an elevation of your neshama. Amen. Amen.
you, Glenna, for sharing your story, and we wish you only good health.
Thank you.
I'm just going to talk for a few minutes about genetics, and then we'll turn it over to Rabbi Weiner. Glenna was so brave to share and so helpful in helping us understand, you know, how BRCA mutation can be passed down through the families, because 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jews, regardless of 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jews, regardless of whether or not they're men or women, can be diagnosed with a BRCA gene mutation, and men and women can equally pass it down to their child. It's a dominant mutation, which means that if you are a carrier, you have a 50% chance of passing it on to your kid. If you are a carrier, you have up to about an 80% chance of breast cancer in your lifetime, and up to around a 40% chance of getting ovarian cancer in your lifetime. You're also at risk for pancreatic cancer and prostate cancer and melanoma and male breast cancer. We actually have a man in the Sharsheret community who was able to detect his pancreatic cancer very early recently because he was part of a high-risk screening study. So knowing that information for him, he fully credits to saving his life, and he is cancer-free from pancreatic cancer today. So what are some of the signs that maybe you should get tested? Certainly, a breast cancer or ovarian cancer, or really any cancer that is at a young age, your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, even 50s is a sign. Obviously, being an Ashkenazi Jew, and a family history of any of the cancers that we just mentioned, and repeated histories of those cancers. So maybe not just a mom, but maybe also an aunt or a cousin. We do hear a lot at Sharsheret families who are reunited over this issue. They get that phone call after not talking with a family member for 10 years, that someone in their family has been diagnosed with this mutation. But there are things that you can do about it if you know and you know early. Prophylactic surgery is probably the most common that we all know. So removal of the breasts, removal of your ovaries is one. But you can also get onto a screening plan through your doctor at Cedars, Kaiser, UCLA, St. John's. All of these medical centers are very familiar with hereditary risk for cancer and can get you on a screening plan that involves breast MRIs, transvaginal ultrasounds, mammograms, switching off on those screenings maybe every 4 months, every 6 months, depending on you and your history. And then many people do choose what's called pre-implantation genetic testing, PGT, which means testing embryos before they're implanted in their bodies so that those embryos can be isolated. And I know you'll talk a little bit about that this evening. Yeah?
My mother had breast cancer when I was a teenager. And just to give another side, she lived to 91. She had never taken a mammogram because they didn't have them at that time. They were just starting. She died 15 years ago. And she lived to 91, full life. And I tested for the BRCA and the whole slew of genes. It's a whole lot more than BRCA. They have like 250 different genes. And I was negative for the gene. So just because, shouldn't be panicking, avoid testing, because just because a relative has had it does not mean you necessarily inherited it. You could have inherited a different gene and not have any problem with it at all.
I think that's such a good point. So there's a couple of things you said that it's really important for people to hear. One is that it's not just the BRCA mutation. There are a whole range of mutations that can increase your risk for different kinds of cancer. CHEK2 is a really common one that you might have heard of. PALB2, Lynch syndrome is connected to ovarian cancer. So when you get genetic testing now, you're not just testing for the BRCA mutations, you're testing for a full panel of mutations. So that's one really important point. The second point is that regardless of family history, 1 in 8 women are diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. So you can test negative for absolutely everything and still develop breast cancer. And you could test absolutely negative for everything. And I've seen this in a lot of families where many of the family members still, there is a clear family history of breast cancer despite testing negative over and over again. Also, if you've tested more than maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it is recommended that you do testing again because so many mutations have been discovered. And the reason for that is because testing is so much cheaper than it's ever been before. And that's the other point I just want you to know, is that tests now cost around $250 if you're paying out of pocket. And insurance very often covers it if you have a family history. And genetic counselors really work with you to get your insurance to cover that. So there are a lot of options. There are incredible genetic counselors at all of the medical centers, including Cedars-Sinai. And like I mentioned earlier, if you're not ready for that, this is part of what Charshare does. We have a genetic counselor on staff that can provide information to you and really talk through whether this is right for you or your family. You know, regardless of what age you are right now, whether maybe you've already been doing mammograms for years or maybe you're just about ready to start doing a mammogram for the first time, there's no wrong time to talk with your provider about you, your family history, and your medical needs. And the last thing I just want to say, and I'm totally around for questions after Rabbi Weiner speaks, but because Glennie spoke about mammograms and the importance of mammograms, currently the American Cancer Society is recommending that people start their mammograms between the ages of 40 and 45. So please keep that in mind. Mammograms every year is what they're saying. And make sure that you're keeping on top of your screening plan. You know, you are your own advocate. You know your body best, and you know your family history. So being able to have all this information decide, you know, what makes sense for you is what we hope you can get out of this evening. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Rabbi Weiner.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, well, good evening, everyone. Thank you, Jenna. I'm a huge fan of Charshare. I've seen firsthand the incredible work that they do in people's lives in our community, and so it's an honor. Anytime they ask me to do anything to help, I'm more than happy to, because I see how impactful they are. So it's an honor to be here tonight. I know this is, you know, a very serious conversation. It's a very important conversation, and I'm hopeful that what I have to share will actually give us a lot of hope, because as has come up, there's a lot of incredible things happening, and the best thing we can do is educate ourselves, and the more we know, the more we can take advantage of these days. And so actually the source of my remarks tonight are I give, like, every couple of years I do presentations for the rabbis in town on, like, what are the newest, most cutting edge medical ethics issues that are, like, starting to happen in the hospitals that the rabbis should be aware of. And I started, you know, obviously took a little bit of a break during COVID, and afterwards I started doing this again, and I realized that out of, like, I gave, like, my top five, what are the top five new, most interesting, you know, earth-shattering things happening, and I realized, like, three out of those five are related to these issues that we're talking about tonight. So I thought we'll just talk about those three, and they actually cover a lot of different issues, and I'll leave a lot of it for you to just be, you know, educated by, and therefore to, you know, find out more, but I'll also share with you some of the approaches that the rabbis are beginning to take. And so, just for example, the first one, it's not related to anything we're talking about at all, but it's just interesting, or people think it's interesting, was, you know, during the pandemic, there was the first heart transplant from a pig. A human got a pig heart transplant. Okay, he didn't survive very long, but he made it 2 months. But that was, like, a very big deal. Everyone was asking all the rabbis, can you get a pig transplant? Is that kosher? What do you think? Yeah. Yes, totally kosher, because it's pekuach nefesh, and also you're not eating it. You're not eating the heart. You just, right, we've had pig heart valves for many, many years, and that's totally allowed. And so to save a life, obviously, that's wonderful. But one of the questions was, like, how did they get that to work? Because it's pretty amazing if we could actually get that to work on a regular basis. How did they get a pig's heart into a human being and that it worked? And the answer is they have a farm, a pig farm in Pennsylvania, where they are genetically modifying the pigs to be like human-like pigs, to have like human genes in the pigs. Which is a little bit scary, but it does bring up some other issues. First of all, it brings up lots of interesting issues. Like, I mean, obviously they're not kosher, but what if you would, just for as a fun thought question, you could ask this at your Shabbos tables, what if you would take that pig heart? Okay, we said a human could get it, save your life, right? But what if you would transplant that into a cow, and then could you eat that cow? Could you have that steak that has a pig heart? Its blood is flowing. I don't. So anyways, it would be treif anyways, because it had a surgery, it'd be treif. But just interesting question. So the interesting thing, though, is that they got this heart to work by genetically modifying it. And that was another major breakthrough that happened in recent years. It's called CRISPR. Have you heard of CRISPR? So CRISPR is genetic engineering. And actually, the first genetically modified baby was born last year in China. Oftentimes we talk about, you know, is this ethical? Is it right? And then all of a sudden someone else doesn't really care if it's ethical or right, and they just do it. And there was a baby born in China a year ago that was genetically modified. They just did one genetic modification because they wanted to be safe. You know, this is like, it's not, trying to see how I don't want to get too controversial. It's not, okay, I'm not going to say it. Never mind. Fine. What I was going to say is it's not, people got concerned that like the vaccine is genetically modifying, but the mRNA technology, it is related to how they can deliver, you know, information to our DNA. And they use that to then do another step. The vaccine was to deliver the vaccine to DNA. The CRISPR actually then cuts the DNA and makes changes. That's very different than the vaccine. And they, now that we know, as not everything, we know more about our genetic, you know, about our genes, about our DNA, we can start looking at like what parts of our DNA cause different things to happen. And researchers are trying to figure out if we can just modify our DNA and treat illness that way, actually. And what these researchers in China did, because they wanted to see if it will work, is they actually, they made a baby, they modified this baby to be immune to AIDS. That was it. They just wanted to do one small thing to see what will happen. And the baby was born healthy. I mean, it's just a baby now, so we don't know what's going to happen. And that was a very minor genetic modification. But it starts to bring up all these different issues. And as you'll see, I'm going to have to go. I'll talk about this, and this is going to lead us to much more relevant topics. But I just think it's so fascinating. It's actually very relevant, as you'll see. But there's so many questions about this. I mean, on the one hand, it's very, very exciting. Because imagine if we could treat illness by just modifying, just fixing our DNA, so to speak. On the other hand, it's very risky because our DNA is who we are. And there is something in medicine called off-target effects. Off-target effects are when you target something and you do get that thing that you targeted, but then you don't realize that that intervention has ramifications. The truth is, in the Torah, we've been talking about this for many thousands of years. For example, what are some things we could do? We know, let's say, about genes that cause Alzheimer's, for example. There are, we can determine which genes can be related to IQ. So what if we wanted to try to modify our children to be brilliant? And, you know, we thought that would be very exciting. So we say, oh, you know what? I want to make my children have a perfect memory. Never forget anything. What a bracha, no? No, you're horrible. Even Rav Sadia Gaon wrote about this 1,000 years ago. Could you imagine if you never forgot anything? I mean, every tragedy, every horrible thing you ever heard was always on your mind. Every, you know, and you always thought it, you could only think about, I mean, it could be really, really bad. In fact, much life is about, you know, the struggle to try to remember what we need to remember, to forget some things, to learn from the past. I mean, it's part of being human is what we do with our memory. But to remember everything, could be very problematic. I mean, it's the 3 weeks now, it's the 9 days. So the rabbis say that, you know, the rabbis were very concerned about the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. And it was a big problem, right? People wanted to worship idols. We can't really relate to it so much anymore. But this is what people were doing. And so the rabbis decided finally to excise it from our DNA. I mean, that they don't use those words, but that's what they did. They cut out the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah from the human. And what happened as a result? No more Nevuah. We lost prophecy. We didn't realize that the ability to have prophecy is connected to the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah. So we cut out one thing and we lost something else that was very good. So there are off-target effects. When we start messing with our DNA, there could be all sorts of unintended consequences. But we do know that we are allowed to play God, so to speak. Actually, also 3 weeks related, there is a great story in the Tanakh about Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Chizkiyahu was a great, great king. Chizkiyahu, however, knew through Nevuah that his children would be very evil. So he decided not to have children because they're going to be evil. And Yeshayahu and Navi, Isaiah, came to him and told him that he was going to die. And he said it was a punishment that he made that decision. So he said, but I know through Nevuah that they're going to do evil things. I'm trying to prevent evil from the world. So Yeshayahu and Navi responded, Hani kavshi derachmana lamalach. It's not your place to play God. You don't get to make those decisions. though we do play God. I mean, we're not anti-playing. We're not anti-playing God in Judaism, right? Do we never do anything to manipulate the world, right? Rabbi Akiva. There's a famous story. The Romans came to Rabbi Akiva and said, "You know, why do you treat the sick? God decided they should be sick. Why do you treat them?" So he said, "Well, why do you eat bread? God only gave us wheat, but we make it into bread. Like, we do believe in manipulating the world, but where is the line? Like, where do we draw the line?" And rabbis are debating this right now about CRISPR, genetic engineering, because they're trying to figure out, like, it's going to happen. If it's going to happen, where are we going to draw the line? So they had to look at precedent. Do we have any precedent in rabbinic literature? And we have one that Jenna mentioned before, and that is PGD. So let's just talk about that for a minute, because this analysis will help us talk about other important things. So it used to be, so this brings us back to the whole conversation of genetic screening. And so I will mention what the rabbis say about PGD. This will help us answer the issue of genetic engineering, and then that will bring us directly to issues related to BRCA and a couple other important discussions. So it used to be, in the olden days, like when I got married 20 years ago this week, that genetic screening. That was very common, but when people found out that they were a match, there was very limited things that we could do about it. When they were not a compatible match is really the right way to say it, I guess. But there wasn't so much they could do, right? The options were basically don't get married because of the concern. And remember, we're talking maybe about BRCA, but there's a whole range of things we could be talking about. We could talk about Tay-Sachs, which is a horrific, horrible disease that causes children to suffer and die in their first few years of life. Or could be talking about, you know, Alzheimer's, let's say, that doesn't even begin until one's in their 80s or 90s. And most likely, I mean, God willing, you know, in that time in the future, we'll already have treatments and cures for it. Like, we don't even, so there's a huge range of what people could be testing for. And that's why, by the way, as a side point, having genetic counselors is so important. Today, we do so much direct-to-consumer genetic testing. You just swab and send it to a lab, and then you get your results. And we don't know what to do with it because it's very complicated. People have to have a master's degree just to be able to become a genetic counselor. And if we think we can understand our results online by getting something in the mail, you really need to have a professional. Anyways, so back in the olden days, the choices were, so don't get married. Another option was just test your luck, get married, and, you know, pray to Hashem and hope for the best, and most likely have a very difficult life. Get married, but not have children. Or the other one, which is not really an option so much in our community, but that if in the literature would be get married anyways and do, you know, uterine testing and then have abortions when necessary, which is obviously much more problematic from a halachic perspective. But that was pretty much it. Then, now there's more and more and more, and I'll explain to you what they are gradually. So then PGD became a thing. So what's PGD? PGD is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where a couple could decide, you know what, we're very much in love. You know, these become excruciating questions. And actually, just from my own experience, I think they're becoming more common, at least just by the amount that I'm dealing with them lately. They feel like they're becoming more common. Imagine a couple, you know, they're young, most likely, right? They're in their probably teenagers or early 20s. They find out this difficult news that they're both carriers for the same genetic mutation. But they feel that they are, you know, a match made in heaven. They want to get married. They're very much in love. So, as I mentioned, in the past, most rabbis would say to them, don't get married. In our community, people would say, there's no really other option, and it's too risky. Today, there's one other option. Well, I'll say the other option in a minute, but the more common, another option is PGD. In PGD, a couple would have to then they would get married, they would get pregnant only through IVF, they'd have to practice birth control, only have children through IVF, and then in the lab, when they have the fertilized egg, they have multiple eggs and fertilized eggs, and they can then test them in the lab and determine what they're carriers for. They can then screen out and remove the eggs that they feel that are carriers for whatever they were screening for. This was a big question with the rabbis. First of all, it's a question of abortion because you are killing a fertilized egg. The rabbis did not feel that this was problematic for that reason, because there is a pasuk in the Torah which says, "Hashofech dam ba'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech." What it really means is, if one who sheds blood of another person has the right to, meaning the Beis Din, has the right to kill them, capital punishment. But the rabbis analyzed this and said, well, wait a second, what's Adam ba'Adam? What's a person in a person? They said, oh, that's Ubar ba'Yerech Imo, that's a fetus in its mother's womb. So they said, that is forbidden to kill a fetus in its mother's womb. But what if it's not in its mother's womb? Well, they can never imagine such a scenario that you didn't have in the times of the Gemara. But today we do. And the rabbis felt, well, that's not really abortion, so to speak, because it's outside of the womb. So the rabbis felt that that could be discarded in a case of need. But the other question became, well, wait a second. So let's say one goes to the lab. Now this couple knows that they are both carriers for something, and they don't want their children to have that. So they're getting pregnant through PGD. It's not an easy way to live. We often, by the way, as a side point, discourage couples from getting married in this case. But oftentimes they do anyways, and that's their decision. But it could be a challenging way to live, but it is an option. Every time they have children, it's usually $30,000 to $40,000 per child just to do this process. And then let's say they do it, and while their doctor, the geneticist is in the lab, they say, okay, look, we have four embryos here who that are not carriers for whatever they were screening for. Which one do you want? We have, a boy, three girls, we have a blonde, a brunette, we have blue eyes, we have a tall one, we have a short one. And they start saying, well, wait, am I allowed to make that decision? Can I choose? And they start asking the rabbis, and it gets really interesting, some of the questions. I can just share with you one interesting one. I spent a summer at Shaarei Tzedek, one summer, 5, 6, 7 years ago, just experiencing what they do there, trying to learn for Cedar Sinai. And they have a fertility lab at Shaarei Tzedek, which is a totally halachic fertility lab. Everything runs according to halacha there, and they have mashgichot that will oversee everything, and they have a rav in charge. And I remember we had a shaila there one day when I was there, that there was a woman and a man who came in. They had six boys, and the husband wanted more children, and the wife said she could not handle many more children. And she said, but if we know we'll have a girl, I would have more. Only if we know it'll be a girl. And he said, okay, if the rabbis let, I'm fine with that. I don't care. I just want to have more children. So they went to this lab, and they asked the shaila, can they do this in order to just to make sure they have a daughter? What do you think? So that's what I thought also was going to be no. This shaila went to Rav Avadi Yosef. They were a Sephardi couple. They went to Rav Avadi Yosef, and he said, since she was definitive, she will not have more children unless they can have assured that it's a girl, he allowed it. And they did it. So, interesting. But PGD is more than that, right? PGD is choosing more than just the gender. And so the rabbis debated this as well. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was the first one that really dealt with this question, and he, had the shoulders, he said, this is Hanikashi Derachmana Lamalach. This is exactly the case of Chizkiyahu, where when it comes to playing God, we don't do. But if it's for a medical reason, then that could be certainly justified. So he allowed it for medical reasons. So this couple, let's say they got married, and they know that they are carriers for a genetic mutation. To prevent the genetic mutation, he allowed it. Not to choose the hair color or the height or things like that. He felt that is cosmetic, and that we don't go this far for, this is too, that would be too much. He probably wouldn't have allowed it unless you could argue, which is what Rav Avadi Yosef said, this might have been a mental health issue. I mean, that's what her argument was. She felt, I can't handle it anymore, and I really want a girl. It was like, it was part of her argument for mental health, and he was moved by her, by what she said. So, yeah. So,
you can't generalize these things. It's case by case.
It's case by case.
Family by family.
Yes, family by family, case by case.
That means everybody can do
that. Right. But it's part of the new frontier. There's going to be a newer frontier, which I'll explain to you in just a couple of minutes, but it's a new option. Meaning it used to be, like I said, the choices were basically get married or don't get married. Most of the rabbis were saying, don't get married if you're both carriers. Although the question always was, how far do we go with it? I mean, if someone's a carrier for something that's not certain and it's not life-threatening, at that point, do you, at what point do you have to even share in Shaduchim this information? It's also a very big question and complicated question, because certainly if it could cause very sick children, it needs to be shared, but when to share, how to share, and what to share, there is a limit at certain points where it's not required to share. Anyway, so that is PGD. So that's relatively new, but not extremely new. There's another thing that can be done, and this is newer. And this came up, but I want to just discuss it for a minute because there's an important halachic conversation to have, which is prophylactic surgeries. In the Orthodox, prophylactic surgeries are halachic questions. A bilateral mastectomy is not such a difficult question, especially to save a life. I mean, that's not really a halakhic question. An oophorectomy, which is removal of ovaries, is a halakhic question because of the prohibition of sirus. Sirus means the prohibition of causing oneself to become infertile. Technically, it's a prohibition, again, for men. But for women, it's a prohibition derabanan. The Vilna Gaon says it's even prohibition deraisa. The first case I had this, and the case, the rabbi I'm going to mention, I'm not going to mention his name, but it wasn't in L.A., but it was when I first started at Cedars, 15 years ago, because I want to show you the progression of how it has changed. And halacha doesn't change, but the metzias changes, right? The reality changes, and so we have to constantly reevaluate. So we have to be careful how we say it. But 15 years ago, I remember a case that we had. I met the patient because she was at Cedars, even though, I mean, I'm very careful, obviously, with confidentiality. In this case, she was not a Los Angeles native. She didn't live in L.A., and her rabbi's not in L.A., so it's not anyone that anyone should know who this was. But she had this question of finding out, you know, a little bit later in life, she was already in her late 30s, that she was a BRCA carrier. And in fact, when her doctors began talking about this with her, she disclosed about how many people in her family she had lost from ovarian cancer. So it was very clear that this was a risk in her family. And her doctor suggested an oophorectomy to remove her ovaries. Like I said, it causes early onset menopause. It causes, obviously, infertility, inability to have more children. And she knew this was a halakhic question. She asked her rabbi, and her rabbi said, no, it's not allowed by halakha. I was shocked. Honestly, I thought that was for sure going to be allowed, but I'd never had that question before. And she was also shocked and upset, but she also was a real, you know, ba'alat emuna. She understood that's what the rabbi says, and she felt, okay, it's not allowed, I'm not going to do it. And she didn't do it. But I didn't get a chance to talk to that rabbi. It wasn't a rabbi who I knew. I was just curious about it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to turn to my rabbis about this. I see this is a new shaila. I looked into it. No one had dealt with it before. It was very new. So I reached out to Rav Asher Weiss, who is the post-ec who I reach out to most frequently, and also Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg in Yerushalayim. And I asked them the Shaila. And they also hadn't dealt with it before, but they wanted data. So it was just at that time that more data was coming out about how accurate both the genetic testing is and how effective the surgery would be. So this was new. Whoever that previous rabbi was didn't have that information. So this is relevant. So I sent them the information, and they looked into it and thought, well, how, you know, you have to have a halakhic mechanism to justify things. What's the halakhic mechanism? You can't just say it's allowed because I want it to be allowed. So they thought about it, and they actually, interestingly, both gave the exact same answer. The answer was, we have a category in halakha called rodef. Rodef is the category that habar lahargecha hashgein vahargo. We are allowed, of course, Judaism, we're not allowed to kill anybody. But if someone's coming to kill you, and you have no other way of saving your life other than killing them, then you could kill them. You have to kill them. So that's called a rodef. If someone's coming to kill you, you kill them to save your life. So they said, you know what? We now know enough. We're now confident enough about genetics. This took time, right? In halakha, we're careful. In fact, I'll tell you a quick side point story. This is I learned from Zvika Reisman. So you know that IVF, just talking about PGD, IVF, Postkim did not allow it when it was new in the late 70s. The Postkim said, no, you cannot do this. There was a lot of concerns. Specifically, Rav Sternbach in Yerushalayim, the guy of the Eda Haredis, said it's completely forbidden. That was in his first volume of Responsa. In his second volume, in the early 80s, he said it's forbidden, but he said it softer. In his third volume, in the mid-80s, he said, I don't like it. I'm not saying it's forbidden, but I don't like it. In his fourth volume, in the early 90s, he said, I'm not saying it's usur, but I'm not saying it's mutter. I'm not saying it's allowed. In his fifth volume, in the late 90s, he said, you know, technically it's allowed. In his sixth volume, in the early 2000s, he said, you know what, the truth is, it's allowed. In his most recent volume, in like 2012, I think it was, he said, it's an obligation. An obligation. I went to meet with him. I brought my son to him. I met with him, and I asked him. Svika was the one who pointed this out to me, that it changed like that. I said, well, it's just so interesting, because the Rav said it was usher, now he said it's required. He says, yeah, this is the halachic way. When things are new, we have to be careful. We need, and my job as a post, like he said, is to protect my community. We don't just grab everything that's new and say, like, oh, let's just try it. Let's be careful first. Let's make sure it's safe. Let's make sure it's really effective in helping people. And let's not just jump on the bandwagon because everyone's doing it. Let's make sure it's, and there's many things that we will stand back on, and we'll see, okay, you know what? I'm glad we didn't jump on the bandwagon. We were better off not getting into that. And he said, this, though, I realized after some time, it really helps a lot of people, and it really is safe, and it really works. And so if it really works and helps people and has opportunity for people to have children who couldn't otherwise have children, I think it's a wonderful thing, so they should do it. So anyways, how did I get to talking about that? Because, the Rodef thing. So Rav Asher Weiss and Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, of blessed memory, Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, and Yibadu L'chaim Tovim, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Zichron Levracha, said that you can apply the category of Rodef because now that we see how effective genetics are at predicting a person's outcomes later in life and how effective the surgical interventions are, we see that it's actually saving lives. Therefore, the gene, person doesn't have to be sick already. Meaning, what I do remember from that first rabbi that was consulted was this woman was not sick. She did not have cancer. So he sort of felt like, how can I tell you to do a surgery when you're not sick? Why should you do a surgery? You're not sick right now. And we didn't know at that time enough about genetics to really say, like, why would we do a surgery when someone's not sick? But now we know today that we can predict things well enough that we can say, you know what, we have reason to act based on the genes. The gene is there even if the illness is not there. And so they allow these surgeries. And actually that psak, thank God, it's been actually a very helpful thing because we were able to share that with a number of people, and it's now published, and people have been able to take advantage of that opportunity. Just a couple more things, and then we'll open up because this leads me to the next thing. So this leads then to the next point, the last kind of thing that I was building up to. And I'll just mention one other thing as a side point. But so what's new in all this? I mean, this is kind of new, but I told you cutting edge, like the last year. This was like kind of older. It's new, but like really new. So here's something really new to think about. So there is a lab at Cedars-Sinai. Sorry that I'm Cedars-Sinai-centric, but I work there. So so there's a lab, a scientist there named Clive Svendsen. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's incredible. He discovered how to manipulate stem cells. You know, stem cells, the future of stem cell, you know, technology is really incredible. Just to give you an example of how futuristic and incredible the things he's doing is, last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, he actually sent a rocket ship into outer space full of stem cells because they're researching on stem cells. They want to see, they think that in zero gravity, they'll be able to manipulate them more and do more things to save lives. So they sent it up to outer space to do the research out there to see how they could save lives. It's really amazing. And I mean, God willing, the stuff that they can do, I mean, with stem cells, you understand, stem cells are, when I mentioned, three embryos before, fertilized eggs, you know, at that first stage, so first if you watch, like, you know, if you go on YouTube or if you watch in a lab, you're like, when an egg becomes fertilized, first it becomes 2 cells, and then 4, then 8, then 16, right, and 32, and then pretty soon it starts to form into actually shape of a baby. But for a while, it's what's called a blastocyst. Those cells are what we call pluripotent. They can become anything. So one cell is going to become a brain, and one cell is going to become fingernails, and one's going to become hair. Like, they become all different things, even though... So when you can manipulate those, you can make that do anything. So speaking of the heart transplant from a pig, well, wouldn't it be more incredible if we could, like, actually just regenerate our own organs? And that's their goal. They're already starting to do that. Like, if you have kidney failure, just, you know, create your own new kidney and then replace your own kidney. Like, it's just really amazing. So one thing that he did that... They just announced was they were doing some work on BRCA, and they decided, and this I don't totally understand what I'm about to tell you, but it's hopefully you get the point of it though. They made in their lab, they showed this to me, I just didn't know what I was looking at, but I went to their lab because I wanted to see it. They created a fallopian tube in a dish. They took a person who is a BRCA carrier, and they took let me tell you one other thing, just to help understand this. See, there is another issue with stem cell research. To the Catholic Church, I mentioned that in Halacha, we're allowed to do PGD because we don't see that as abortion. In the Catholic Church, it is abortion because they believe that conception is when life starts. So to them, it's abortion already. Therefore, stem cell research is not allowed to them. So therefore, depending on who's president, and I promise this is not political, I'm not making political statements, I'm just sharing with you the science. It does depend, though, on who's president, if they will fund stem cell research. So, because the Catholic Church is very strong in politics. So, when Clive Svendsen was doing a lot of his research, he wouldn't get funded by the government. So they had to figure out, well, what are we going to do? You need millions of dollars. Can you imagine? They sent this rocket ship to space. Like, imagine how much money it costs to do this research. So so he figured out in their lab how to take adult stem cells and rewind them to the pluripotent stage like they're an embryo. So you don't have to worry. It's not like abortion at all to anyone. It's amazing what they're doing. So now that you understand that technology, not that you understand it because I don't understand it, but now that you get that, though, they took people's cells who have BRCA. They then put them in the fallopian tube in the petri dish, rewound them like they're a baby. And then they said, now you know what we could do? We can now fast forward them and watch how they develop. And then that person who gave us their stem cell, we are now watching their life play out in the petri dish. So we can now say, take a person and say, okay, you're a carrier for whatever the gene is. Let's just take your stem cells. We'll put it in the petri dish. We'll fast forward it. And we'll tell you what you will have or what you will not have and exactly what age you will get it and what the best treatment will be for it. And by the way, age is important because, as you know, these one of the very difficult halakhic questions ends up becoming, let's say, I forgot to say this before, let's now that we said an oophorectomy is allowed by halakha, but what's the right age to do it? Because obviously people want to first have their children and then do the surgery. In fact, someone once asked me a question. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine from Lakewood. He was telling me a shayla he got about this. And I was like, oh, you want to hear an L.A. version of that shayla? So here's the question. Here's what actually how it happened. Her aunt dies of ovarian cancer. Her grandmother had died of ovarian cancer. Someone says to her, you know, you should really get tested. She gets tested. She finds out she's a carrier. What age were her relatives? In their mid-30s when they first got sick. She is now 31 years old. She's like, okay, I should probably do something. She finds out she is a carrier. But she really wants to have children. Her boyfriend is not Jewish. She obviously wanted to marry a Jew, but she's also now in a rush. So her question to the rabbi was, Rabbi, can I marry a non-Jew? The kid's going to be Jewish, but in order to then save my life, to have children and save my life. What do you think the rabbi's answer to that question is? No, definitely not. But although I could sympathize. I mean, I still sympathize. But it's a very difficult, sad question. But I told my he was like, yeah, you're right. That's we didn't get that question in Lakewood. But but you see how you can imagine how difficult these questions are. So but now with this new technology that they discovered, imagine if you could tell a person, okay, unfortunately, this person is a carrier. But we can now watch the development of their own genes in the lab and say, okay, well, it's at age 36 and 4 months. That's when it's going to be an issue for you. So you have this many years. And we can see, by the way, will surgery be the best for you because of the way it's going to spread? Or there are some chemotherapies that are very effective and some that are not. And so they could say, well, let's check all the chemotherapies on your own cells in the lab, not on you, and see if yours will be if it will be effective on you or not. And they can say, okay, here, we have a treatment, we know what age, like the whole thing. What do you think about this? Is this halakhically problematic?
No.
I agree that's not halakhically problematic. I do have one concern. And the truth is, it's related to Chizkiyahu HaMelech also, which is all related to the Churban Beis HaMikdash, because Chizkiyahu HaMelech was really like the last good king. Okay, his grandson became Menashe, which with time Hashem decided to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So Chizkiyahu HaMelech did something else when he was king. What did I mention before? He didn't have children because he was afraid they were going to become evil. Isaiah convinced him to have children. He has children. His children are, in fact, evil. And, in fact, Menashe's grandson kills Isaiah, which is the whole irony of the whole thing. But anyways, he did something else. Menashe saw all the idol worship that was happening in the land of Israel at that time. And he was trying to lead a tshuva revolution and get rid of the Avodah Zarah. So, in fact, it was so bad that the Nachash HaNechoshes, you know, the copper staff that Moshe used to heal the people when they looked at it, that was still in the Beis HaMikdash at that time. But the people were praying to the Nachash HaNechoshes, to the staff. And so Menashe decided to destroy it. He also destroyed, there was something called the Sefer Refuos. There was a book of healing at that time. By the way, most of the cures were cedars, were arazim. That's why cedars are Lebanon. So anyway, just since I was talking about cedars, I know. So Sefer Refuos, he got rid of it. And the rabbis said that he did the right thing. Because the Sefer Refuos, people had the cure to every illness. They didn't dive into Hashem anymore. They felt, Kochi v'otzim yadi. We could do everything. We have complete control of the human body, of the human physiology. We don't need Hashem anymore. We got it. We figured it out. So he destroyed the Sefer Fuos. Do you think this is similar at all?
Potentially.
It's potentially like, is it getting to the point where like sort of playing God? On the other hand, it is saving. It could save lives. It's worth it. But it's just a challenge. Like, we have to remember, like, what they call this in medicine today, precision medicine. That's where medicine is going, precision medicine. So I asked Clive Svensson, this starts to bring it all around full circle, and I'll start to wrap up now. I asked him, when I went to his lab to see this, I had to see it, and I, you know, and now he lets me, he has a journal club every week that I go to, because I'm, like, so fascinated by what he's doing. And I went to his lab to meet with him, and he showed me what they're doing. Now, this technology that I just mentioned, it worked in the lab, in the Petri dish, then it worked with mice, and now they're recruiting adults to do it in. Wow. So it's not available yet for human beings. But he thinks within 5 years, they'll be able to offer this to people. That's pretty soon. So I asked him, okay, well, what's next? So you have this technology. You can now take a person and tell them what their genes mean for them exactly, precisely. What's your next? Like, what will be next? He, like, got a big smile on his face. He's like, well, Rabbi, I don't know if you're going to be okay with this, and we'll discuss this. Next will then be, we can offer them to just remove the gene. CRISPR. Once we have identified the gene, why not just cut out the gene? That's where we're going to go next. But, of course, that's going to require lots of ethics review and discussion. And so we're not going there now. But that is going to be halachic. That's a big question. Because the question is going to be, I mean, I'm not going to get into it too much now. There's so much thought experience we could have about it. But imagine, so the rabbis are likely going to say no. Unless maybe we follow what we did for PGD, what Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, which was that if it's for health, for a therapeutic reason, maybe it will be allowed. But then again, we need to know that it's actually going to be not going to have off-target effects. And what are we going to do? What's going to happen if, let's say, China, as an example, they say, oh, we're going to make everyone brilliant and strong and, you know, and so what will happen? Like, Americans will be weak and dumb and we're going to try, like, at what point will we say, like, oh, it's not fair? Like, the world, so who knows what the future brings? But the good thing is it brings a lot of potential. There's one more, should I say one more? Or just end it there. Are we out of time? Okay, one more issue, just as a side point, just to mention, just because I feel like it's about, this evening is about information and also hopefully hope, but these are difficult topics. I mean, these are horrific things to think about, but it's like, hopefully it feels good to recognize that like things are happening, things are moving, the rabbis understand and are working with it, the scientists are creating incredible things, and hopefully they'll be responsible with the science. Another question that I've personally got, I'm not a post-it guy, I mean, I turn to Rabbi Sauer, Rav Asher Weiss, but I get all the questions in the hospital, and then I turn to the rabbis. But I see lately, and I just realized that, you know, and I promise this, I don't talk about politics, but since Roe versus Wade, you know, Roe got overturned, I just see another thing on the horizon that's, I already had this issue twice. And how long has it been? A month since it got overturned? I mean, in California, nothing changed, right? But there is another issue just to think about, just to be aware about. We should have thought about these things, which is that one of the very common times that women unfortunately find out that they have cancer is when they're pregnant, because that's when we are spending more time in doctor's offices and having screenings and imaging and different things, and sometimes it's found. Now, standard protocol is that if someone needs to begin chemotherapy, it will not be administered to somebody who is pregnant. And so often that creates a harrowing decision of terminating a pregnancy in order to save the mother's life. Now, normally we say you could save the mother's life, and in fact, I mean, I could just tell you because he said this publicly, Rav Asher Weiss encourages the abortion in those cases because he argues the same issue, the rodef. We know that an abortion is allowed in halacha if the baby is a rodef, meaning if it's risking the mother's life. In the classic case, it's when the pregnancy is literally risking the mother's life. It has to be terminated. In this case, though, that baby, that fetus, is not risking the mother's life. The baby is healthy. The baby's innocent, so to speak. It's the cancer that's risking the mother's life. Is that still a rodef? So Rav Asher Weiss argues that the Gemara says that there's a case where there's people on a boat, and the boat was too heavy, and they threw a donkey overboard to save the people's lives. And they said the donkey was the rodef. And there's a big discussion, like, how is that donkey the rodef, though? Who says that donkey was the rodef? And he says the rodef can even be an indirect rodef. And in this case, the baby's an indirect rodef. So he strongly encourages it. But this is not an easy question because, especially when we talk about fertility treatments and people who have had a hard time, women who've had a hard time getting pregnant, and they often don't want to, obviously, who wants to terminate a pregnancy? So it's an excruciating, difficult question. But I just bring it up again because it's like another thing just to think about. And we say, you know, in the base medrash, we always say it should be la halacha v'lo la maisa. There's like a saying, like, it should be for discussion. And if we discuss it, then we won't have to know from it. So hopefully it's just something to discuss, but not to actually have to know la maisa. But just to mention, because it is, these are halachic issues, but thank God our tradition, our Masorah halacha has guidance for us, has, you know, every case is case by case. You have to ask your rabbi. But there are approaches. And at the end of the day, Judaism emphasizes saving life and doing what we can to save our lives, and there's so much that can be done. And I'll just conclude with the words of Moshe Feinstein. When genetic screening first came out and it was new, it was a big debate in the Orthodox community. Should we be testing? Right? That's when Dor Yesharim was founded. And there were some who said, no, don't test. Like, it's just going to cause anguish, and what can you really do about it? And it's just going to upset people. Don't do the testing. You're better off. It's Ayin Hara. You know, don't look. And Reb Moshe responded. He wrote this in a tshuva. He said, not testing is kesgiras ta'inayim l'mashiyachol liros. It's like closing your eyes to what you could see. It's like crossing the street blindfolded, he said. And so there's so much that we can see today. And so, you know, if we can see it, we should be looking, because it can save our lives. And in the merit of looking and asking these questions and having these conversations, which are difficult conversations, the fact that you all came out to have this conversation, which I think you all knew, like, coming tonight is not going to be an upbeat, I mean, it's difficult issues, but it's so important. And our lives are enriched by having these conversations. And through having these conversations and discussing these things and discussing the halachos, may HaKadosh Baruch Hu protect all of us, our families, all of Klal Yisrael. May we only know Besuros Tovos. And may Hashem heal all those who are not well and protect everyone else. We should just know goodness, happiness. This should be the last Tisha B'Av. Hopefully it won't be Tisha B'Av this weekend, but if it is, this should be the last one. The Sefer Refuos should be back, and we should all learn from it. In Yerushalayim, I'll use the cedars in the Sefer Refuos. I'll be able to leave cedars and use the cedars in Shari Tzedek, and we'll all just, you know, go there for simchas and celebrate together. Thank you. Sure.
If a woman decided she
was
going to take out her ovaries because of a prophylactic method, couldn't they take out eggs and just freeze the eggs?
Yes, you're right. I should have mentioned that. Egg freezing is halakhically permitted and a wonderful thing to do. Yes.
So if anyone has an older sibling, you know, an older child,
yes,
who's not married, you can also freeze eggs.
In fact, that would have been better for this girl I mentioned who the question about marrying the non-Jew, what she should have done is freeze the eggs and then use them later. But yes, you're right. Good point. Thank you.
Will those eggs develop the ovarian?
Well, you'll have to test them. They might be carriers as well.
But they could be not carriers.
Right.
They're not guaranteed to be there.
Right. Yes.
That's probably like a really dumb question, but I just, stem cells, I understand with, you know, with a fetus, but where are the stem cells in an adult? I don't understand where.
We have our whole body of cells.
Right.
And they're no longer really stem cells. They're now individuated cells,
skin cells, muscle cells,
but they have the capability now of rewinding those cells in the petri dish into becoming stem cells,
okay.
And then they can then fast forward, so they can take a skin cell, rewind it to becoming pluripotent, and then fast forward it to becoming a heart.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
There were, I don't know if this is halakhically okay, there were people who were saying to take fetal stem cells and use it in place of like put it in someone's knee,
right,
who was having difficulty walking,
yes,
and instead of knee surgery,
right, regenerate.
Yes. Is that halakhically?
Yes, definitely. That's a great. That's still in its early stages, but that's a great healing technology. Yeah. Yes. Off-target effects. There haven't been with the stem cells. It's not really changing the cells in the same way. It's within what they're capable of. CRISPR is actually changing them, editing them. So that's where we're more concerned about off-target effects. Yeah. So I'm not in a rush. I'll be hanging around. I know Jenna is too, and we're happy to discuss more. And lovely to meet all of you. And thank you again for hosting. And,